This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Boonwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. The land on which I am lucky enough to raise my son always was and always will be Aboriginal land. This episode of Ready or Not is brought to you by me, Lucinda, and my witching hour co-host, business partner, cousin-in-law, and pretend big sister, Loz.
We'll be releasing our very first Ready or Not go-to guides dropping on the 1st of April. We've created three practical and comprehensive guides starting with breastfeeding and returning to work, postpartum planning for the fourth and fifth trimester, and childcare 101. Head to our show notes to sign up for early access and a cheeky discount code.
I remember him saying like, oh, I've taken him to the park, and sometimes I feel like the other mums kind of look at me like, oh, what are you doing? There's nothing else to say about it. It was just the worst because she was my best friend. She was everything to me. And if I had any spare time to myself where my husband would have the kids, I would go and sit with dad. I remember having a group coaching session and I just broke down and I felt awful. I'm the coach. I'm supposed to help everyone else. I just think women have this tendency to apologise for success. I must have got lucky there. It's like, no, you did the work to get there. Most people need to make money. I'm not shying away from that, but put it in perspective. Your family is the most important thing. Work comes and goes, but you can't get time back.
I had a business coaching session with mother and My Daily Business founder, Fiona Kalaki, last year. And in one short hour, she rocked my world. So I had to get her on the show. And listening back to this interview on the other side of pregnancy, she's rocked my world all over again. This episode has so much, it's almost too hard to intro. Losing parents as a young mum, her husband's reflections of what the other mums thought about him at the playground, IVF, pregnancy loss, being a part of the sandwich generation, that is, caring for her ageing parents at the same time as her young children, and a whole lot of thoughtful business advice sprinkled throughout too. This is a special episode, and I thank Fiona for sharing her highs and lows so beautifully. I'm Lucinda, this is Ready or Not, and here is the formidable and fabulous Fiona Kalaki. Fiona, we often talk about the challenges that come with navigating motherhood and career, but I've had a session with you. I know that you like to use your time wisely, so I have a feeling that motherhood may have benefited your work in some ways. Am I right?
Yes, I'm literally laughing like, yes, it sure did. I think because you have these people that, like, there's an end point. I feel like I'm someone, I think you're, from what I know about you, and lots of women that are quite ambitious, go out there and just could keep working. You know, you could just keep working and working. And because you enjoy what you do, I mean, I could sit here till midnight every night and I would enjoy it. But you have these children that are like, they have to be fed, they have to be picked up from school, they have to be picked up from childcare, or, you know, they're home with you. And so it's this total giving of yourself of like, somebody else's needs have to come ahead of mine. And so I think that has been instrumental and has, I mean, my eldest son was the reason I started my business, and his needs have completely transformed the way that I run my business in terms of time management, because he has basketball, you know, 5 days a week, he has other things on. And so I've had to basically run my life around my kids and what they need.
That's amazing. And you can't really, there's no training wheels for it. It just goes from one day being about you to one day being about them.
Yes.
So I can't wait to hear more about that. But let's take it back to the start now. What did career life look like for you pre-motherhood?
So I've had a bit of a, well, this, you can't see me, but, you know, up and down kind of career, I would say. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I was one of those people that was like, I'll do an arts degree because that's what you do when you don't know what else you want to do. Whereas I had three elder siblings who all knew exactly what they wanted to do. Oh, my eldest brother, he kind of didn't quite know, but he ended up spending 10 years at university and became a professor in psychology. But he knew he wanted to do sciences. My sister always wanted to be a doctor and always a regional GP, which is exactly what she is. And my other brother worked in finance as a CFO and then switched to become a lawyer. So I had this very, like, you know, my siblings knew exactly what they wanted to do. I just did not. So I did an arts degree. I moved to London on a one-way ticket, didn't know anyone, worked at magazines, thought because I was 21 with an arts degree, I would just get a job. And it's like, no, that's not going to happen. So I did a whole bunch of interning at different, like, glossy magazines and, you know, different places in the UK. And then I worked at an ad agency because it was the only place I could get a job. And I was the executive assistant to the managing director of an ad agency. So I learned a lot about, you know, ads and selling and all of that sort of stuff. And then from there, though, I came back after a year and a half in London because my best friend had passed away in a car accident and sort of like life is short sort of thing. Came back and studied journalism. And then I got a job with The Age doing their classifieds and ads. And then I started interning, or really just working for my friend who had passed away. Her father ran a factory in Melbourne making clothes. He was from Italy. That whole story, came over with nothing, built this huge business for himself. And so I learned how to cut patterns. And whilst I was there, I was learning a lot about the textiles industry in Australia and how it had all changed and everything was going overseas. And so then I pitched to write an article. Actually, I wrote to Jess Scully, editor of Yen, and she was like, "I really like the way you write. Do you want to write an article?" I was like, "Yeah, what will I write about?" She was like, "You know, I need a story idea quickly." So I was like, "I'll talk about the fashion industry in Australia and how it's changed," because that's what I'd learned in the factory. And so I interviewed all these women in the factory and all this other stuff. And because I had one article to send out to other magazines and it was about fashion, that's what I got lumped doing, fashion. And then I got the job as the editor of Fashion Journal. That was my first proper job, which is a street press. At the same time, David Jones and General Pants, which are big department stores here, they were really looking for a way to tap into a younger market, and it wasn't social media. So they created magazines, and I was the editor of the David Jones custom publishing title, as well as Fashion Journal and in this arts magazine. Then I decided I wanted to get into book publishing, and I wanted to do a postgrad in book publishing, but the guy who was running it, he wouldn't let me get into the course at RMIT unless I worked in book publishing. He's like, "Magazines is not enough. You need to get into book publishing." So I found myself a job at Pearson, which is an education book publisher, worked there, got in and did my postgrad, and at the same time got offered to audition for the Age social column, because a guy who'd worked with me at Fashion Journal, he was working there, he was like, "The woman who does the social column, the social pages for the Age, she's going to quit. If you want, you can audition." So I auditioned, which meant literally going to an event, talking to people, which is not my comfort zone at all. And then I got that role. So I was making good enough money to quit my job at the book publisher, do my study, and then do this column in the Age newspaper, and then start my own business helping fashion companies get online with content. So that took me up until I got married. And then when we got married, I said to my husband, "I want to..." Oh, and I was also ghostwriting for celebrities' books at the same time. And started, I had some people contact me to write their family history in a book. So I'd spend time with like these 94-year-old women for weeks on end dictating their life in a book. So it was really fun, that kind of running my own business. Then I moved to London, and because I'd done well in Australia, I thought we'd move to London and we'll just run our own businesses. And oh my gosh, it was ridiculous. Moved in the global financial crisis. I went for 300 jobs. I got 17 interviews and I got to the final round and got knocked back every single time because it was, you don't have UK experience. And that was devastating because I'd gone from, oh, I've got, you know, the back page of the column and the newspaper every week and I'm doing this and that and working with all these big brands. And then it was a big eye opener of like, no, this is not as easy as you think it's going to be. And then I got a job at Open University looking at their MBA program, but that was outside of London. So it was a big commute every day. And I worked on their MBA program looking at how do we create a really engaging online program for people who, most people are doing an MBA after hours or on the weekend, in addition to a full-time job and potentially a family as well. Worked there, but because it was in Slough, it was so, no, it wasn't in Slough, it was in Milton Keynes. And then that was just too far to travel. So I found a recruiter. They got me a job at Amazon. And then I headed up the kitchen and home team at Amazon, wanted to have a baby, moved to Audible because it was a part-time job. And I knew that I wanted to get pregnant and I didn't know how long that would take. But I knew that a full-time job at Amazon, which was another out of London, like commute, Audible was in London. It was 3 days a week, went for that job, got it, and then got pregnant. And then came back to Australia and worked at a digital agency, ended up at Mimco, head of marketing at Mimco, and then started my business. So it has not been like this, oh, I worked here for 12 years and then I did this. It is so many different places.
Incredible journey though. Wow, that's so colourful. So obviously you were quite thoughtful in how motherhood would come into a work life. Was it something that you thought about for a long time before? Were you one of those people thinking about that in your 20s forever in the back of your head?
Yeah, well, I always wanted children, always. I was obsessed with dolls. My favorite book was Faraway Tree because she got a doll that came to life. And I just wanted to be a mother. However, I did not have boyfriend after boyfriend after boyfriend. So many people sat me down and they're like, you know, do back to the other side, which was completely fine if I did. But I was just like, no, and that's nothing wrong with that. But I love men. I just haven't found anyone good and I'm not going to settle for crap. And I saw so many of my friends settling for these jerks And so I was single for ages. And so I kind of like thought, I really want a kid, but maybe it's not in my, you know, maybe I'll just be the single cool aunt and travels and does all these amazing things without children. And then I met my husband when I was 26 and we got married quickly, moved in after 5 months, got married. And then he was keen to start a family, but I was like, I want to go to London. I want to have a bit of a travel and then we'll start one. But I kept putting it off. Like each year he'd be like, what do you think? And I'm like, no, we haven't had enough us time yet. So I didn't get pregnant till I was 31 and had the baby at 32.
And so you're pregnant, you're working 3 days a week at this stage, I believe. How did pregnancy alongside work go for you, especially in a city that's not yours? Your family aren't around you, I gather.
Yeah, no one was in London. And I didn't really answer your question before, sorry. My sister had taken a long time to get pregnant. So when I was thinking about, I want to start this, I want to be serious at this, I thought it might take a year. And I knew that the commute to Amazon, which was outside of London, plus I was just working nonstop at Amazon, I just didn't think that would be great for trying to get pregnant. So sorry, that answers your question. Yeah, so it was great. Audible was an incredible place to work. It was a small office in London. They were just night and day to Amazon. So Amazon has a very frugal mentality. So if any of my clients had come in that I was working on their marketing in the Amazon platform, if I wanted to buy them like a Diet Coke, I would have to buy it out of my own money. There was no like marketing spend or anything like that, at least not for me in my position. And so then I moved to Audible, where they had breakfast delivered every week, like porridge pots, and you know, just incredible. They would have this beautiful communal lunch every week. There was these restaurants, everyone would take time out, like, let's go get a coffee. It was all very relaxed in comparison to Amazon, which was amazing, but work. So it was great, and I had a really easy pregnancy. I got a bit of morning sickness, but I loved being pregnant. I just enjoyed it so much. Audible was a really fun place to be. I had two women next to me, one who'd just come back from maternity leave, one who was trying to get pregnant. So it was just that really lovely, great place to work. I loved it. I loved it. It was really easy. And I feel guilty saying that because I think a lot of people that work and be pregnant, you know, it's really difficult. I felt so much support from them, from the whole Audible team.
That sounds like a dream scenario. So what was the maternity leave plan then for you?
I had thought, could we go back to Australia? I just didn't know for sure. So Audible gave you up to a year off in England. I can't really remember. I think you get paid. I don't know if I got anything from the government. I can't really remember, but I did get enough from Audible. They paid me for, I don't know, 18 weeks or I can't remember the exact, but I remember thinking it's okay. Plus my husband at the time, and this always sounds so wanky, my husband had been modeling. So he kept getting asked to be a model, which was sort of like a joke between us because he's the least model type person in the world. But because he was modeling, it was great as well because he would do like one job and he might go to Germany he flew to Australia while I was pregnant to do a huge beer campaign. And then he would come back and then he'd have like the rest of the month off. So we were kind of both off. It was so nice.
Amazing.
And you know, occasionally he'd be going away and that was a bit hard, you know, when you've got this brand new baby and you have no one around you. But yeah, it was really good.
And so your son is 8 months old, I believe, when you make the move back to Melbourne.
Yes.
Was that driven by loneliness or a lack of support with not having family around you?
Yeah. So I had an incredible group of women. And if anyone is listening and goes to London and gets pregnant, the NCT, which is the National Childbirth Trust, do an education kind of training and you can go and meet other mums. And I met these women who I'm still in contact with 10 years later now. And I just met in London this year for a catch up. And they were incredible. We met every single week. However, it was becoming more and more obvious that like, okay, once this child gets to a point where I'm going to have to go back to work, like, what are we going to do? My husband's family was here. My family was here. Also, we'd migrated, my family had. And so I'd grown up with no cousins, no aunties and uncles. They're all overseas. And so I wanted my kids to grow up with cousins. And I kept hearing from my sister and my brothers about, oh, the kids have all got together or it's so-and-so's christening or whatever. And I was like, we're just missing out so much. And our parents, not my husband's parents, they're a bit younger, but my parents were aging. And I was like, I just want to go home and see them all before, you know, I don't want it to be too late. Plus the weather in London is not great. It's just grey and miserable half the year. And also it's just getting, I don't know, it's getting to a point where like I was taking the pram onto the tube. No one would help you. No one would, you know, everyone's like, get out of my way. You know, it was just a point where I thought, I'm going to go home. It's much nicer in Australia.
I could totally understand that, having family around. It's very helpful when you have kids. So then what does returning to work look like? I imagine you then need to find a new job back in Melbourne.
Yeah. So I had arranged for, so when I was on maternity leave, I was doing a whole bunch of freelancing and I helped, because it's just me, my nature. And so I helped this company in Australia write a book on how to get people online who had been fashion brands, called Taking Back Retail. And the guys who write it run this digital agency called Portable. And so they had offered me a job before I came back from London. They had said, we'll create a job for you. What sort of job do you want? Which was amazing. But I couldn't take that job until I could find childcare. And I think that was the hardest thing. In London, it's much easier to find childcare. In Australia, I had put him down at, I think, 20 different childcare places around Fitzroy, the inner suburbs of Melbourne, inner north, everywhere. And everyone was like, we've got a 1-year waiting list. We've got a 2-year waiting list. And so he ended up going for, we lived with my parents, which is out in the outer eastern suburbs. And we were really lucky that we could. So, but I couldn't find anywhere for him to go. And my parents were not in a position to be able to look after him. They had their own health challenges. I mean, they looked after him, but not full time or anything. So eventually I found one day a week in Ringwood that he could go to. And then I eventually found a place in Collingwood that would take him 2 days. And I started crying as soon as she said, yes, we have a place, because then I could start the job 2 days a week.
Let me take you back to freelancing in London. Were you just working when you could around a baby's needs? And how soon after your baby did you start freelancing?
So I had this Spanish company who'd contacted me because I wrote a lot at the time for Cool Hunting. And actually Cool Hunting had paid for me to cover Copenhagen Fashion Week. And I flew my son and my husband out there. And that was like amazing. But I just felt like I had so much energy because I'd gained a lot of weight. And I don't want to necessarily talk about weight, but I'd gained a lot of weight when I was pregnant. And I had then, you know, wanted to get back to myself. And so I had done so much like working out. I had this great, just had this brilliant setup. I like got up in the morning, I'd made a grid juice. Then I went to the park and met my friend Caroline, who had a baby at the same age. She was part of my NCT group. We'd walk for an hour and a half. Then we'd sit and have coffee. Then I'd come back. Then I'd do a workout while the baby slept. Like it was just.
Wow, you had it all together.
Brilliant love, but also my husband was home. Like I have to say, he was home a lot of the time. So it was like he could help. So anyway, when I went to Copenhagen, I'd met this guy who was starting basically Pinterest, but it was shoppable. So I helped him with that. Then a friend back home was doing something for Yellow Pages. She's like, can you help me? So it was kind of probably 6 months. Oh, no, probably 4 months. And then the Pinterest job came at 6 months. And so I was also trying to accumulate a bit of money because the maternity leave had cut and I didn't know, you know, what Australia would be like. I knew we needed some money to like go and rent a place and stuff. But yeah, I have to say I had a really lovely, easy baby who he didn't sleep that well, but he loved being in the little, what do you call it? Like that bouncy chair.
Oh,
thing.
The bouncer, yeah.
And I'd put him in front of me sometimes when I was doing my workout and he'd just be laughing and everything because I'd be sweating and dancing all around. And so I just sort of made it work. Plus, I have to say as well, I loved being back home with family in Australia. But in that time in London, we had no obligations. There was no like, you have to be here on Sunday. You have to meet this person. You know, so-and-so's had this, she wants to see the baby. Everything was just whatever my husband and I wanted to do.
That's really interesting. I've never thought about that. We're currently living with my parents even, which we're really lucky to do as well while we do some renovations. And there's a lot of extra times where I would find pockets of work that now I feel like I shouldn't because we're around my parents. So I totally get that.
Yeah.
So then you return to work in, I guess, a more formal way when you get back to Melbourne. How did you find the early days of returning to paid work as a mum?
That agency, they were both dads, the guys who ran it. And even though it was in a growth phase, they were really, I feel like they both had children at similar ages. And so they understood. Like, I remember crying in front of one of them and going, oh my God, I finally got childcare. And he was like, yeah, like he got it. So I feel like they were very, really flexible, to be honest. I feel like they were really like, yeah, if you need to leave early, that's fine. It was a great place to work. Plus a lot of the other people that they hired, they also were either trying to start a family or having young children. We were all at a similar season of life. I think that made a huge difference because they understood what was going on. Plus my husband was freelancing at that time. So he ended up going part-time and looking after my son when I then took a full-time job after the agency.
So it sounds like your husband was quite present from day dot. It wasn't returning to work full time after 2 weeks. What do you think that has done for your relationship and just for his life as a dad of understanding what normally is what the primary caregiver is sort of expected to do just based off the fact that they're the one at home for the first year?
Yeah, he loved it. He did say, I remember him saying like, oh, I've taken him to the park and sometimes I feel like the other mums kind of look at me like, oh, what are you doing? You know, you're not one of us. So he was like, I remember having a conversation where he sort of said, you know, there's all this, everyone's shouting out there going, men should do more. But then when they do more, I don't feel like they're accepted into the
fascinating.
Yeah. So he was like, you know, I'd take him to the park and I'd try and chat to somebody. And then I think they think, what am I trying to pick them up? Or, you know, like it's, which I hadn't thought about, you know, whereas if you're a mum and you're there and there's another mum, you can be like, oh gosh, is he sleeping? Or, you know, like just make conversation. So I think that was really interesting, but he is such a hands-on dad. He still works full time. He had a fantastic dad. His father passed away, unfortunately, last year. And I think he wanted to have that same relationship with his sons. So his family comes first. He's also from a Anglo-Indian background. Both of his parents are from India. And I think that culture of family first has been huge in him. And it is coming through in how he parents as well. I'm incredibly lucky to have such a supportive partner.
Sounds like great foundations for setting up family life, because we know that first year is critical and then what happens after that in terms of a parenting relationship. So that sounds incredible. So then in 2015, you give birth to another baby, and that is your business baby, and oh, that's My Daily Business. You were like, no, I didn't.
No, I didn't. yes, my company, yes.
Yeah, so you've now written books, you've created over 300 podcast episodes, you've made courses, you've helped multiple businesses and business people. Did you foresee any of that when you started this business? Like, was the aim always to go really high?
No. Oh, that's so nice that you say really high. It's funny how people perceive. I'm like, oh, no, I'm just doing my normal stuff. No, when I first started the business, I'd come out of head of marketing at Mimco and decided to take this shot of trying, and I gave it a year. But I thought I would go and consult to corporates. Like, I thought originally, you know, corporates, they're going to pay lots of money. I can go in, I can have the same sort of lifestyle as the head of marketing, but not so many hours. And then quickly I was meeting so many small business owners, and I knew that already, that they'd said, I need help. But I'd kind of thought there will always have to be corporate consulting because that's what's going to pay the bills. So I hadn't really thought, definitely at the start, I did not think, oh, I could have this whole business at home. Like, I knew that that's eventually what I would love to do, but definitely I thought, no, I'm going to be commuting in and out of the city, in and out of boardrooms, doing corporate consulting. And you know, if I get to work with some creative small business owners, that would be nice.
And so what happens then? You do launch. What do you do in the early days that you think set you up for the business you now own?
I think, and I talk about this all the time with clients and in our marketing course as well, I always positioned my marketing for who I wanted to work with, not who I was working with. So I wasn't positioning any of my marketing around corporate consulting. So when I started Instagram, really, under My Daily Business Coach, I said, I'm going to post every day. I mean, this is back in the day when, you know, that mattered. And I post every day. And also I made myself a rule book that I would never post a quote from, you know, Richard Branson, like all the typical entrepreneur, Tim Ferriss, all of that. And that I would really try and pinpoint interesting, creative small business owners that people may not have heard of. And so that's what I started with. And when I started like Brand Watch Wednesday, and I would put a brand in there that people may not have heard of and why I thought they were good. And then I just started very slowly, you know, accumulating followers. And I had a link in there that said, you know, sign up for an email. And I had 9 people sign up, and I started a Sunday email, which is still going today and it has thousands of people on it. So I think the biggest thing is that I positioned it for a creative small business owner that needed help, as opposed to who I was actually working with for the first year, which was, I did work with some small business owners. I worked with a psychology firm. I worked with a skincare company that was trying to get into the US, but I did also get a lot of money from L'Oreal, social media agencies, Australia Post, you know, lots of bigger names. That's who was paying most of the bill, even though that was not who I was marketing towards.
And so you were a mother working for someone else, and then all of a sudden it's sort of all on you, on top of motherhood really being all on you or all on both parents. What were some of the challenges of going from working for someone else and clocking off at a certain time to then working for yourself? Because I know at the moment, like, sometimes it works really smoothly, and other times my son needs to be at home because he's sick from daycare. My husband's trying to finish our reno, so he's quite generous with swapping in when he can, but sometimes I'm like, well, we've got a baby coming, you need to finish that type thing. And then I'm working from bloody 8 p.m. till 1 a.m. So how did you go with that change of working for yourself?
So I have to say, when I started working for myself, my son was 3. So, or just, he just turned 3. So he was not a brand new baby. So it was kind of different. He'd already been set up with childcare. He was going to childcare 3 days a week, I think. And I also had a lot of help from my mum. I would go to my mum's house all the time with, this is the year before. I was thinking, when have I got the dates? No, I would go to my mum's house that first year a lot, and she would take him and I would bring my laptop and do some stuff in the front room, or she would take him and she'd always say, Fiona, go off, go get a coffee, go and enjoy yourself. And so I'd have that bit of downtime while she looked after him. But in terms of my work, because I was working corporate, I had very clear, like, okay, on this day, I go into Australia Post. On this day, I go into do that workshop for L'Oreal. But I was working a lot on the weekends. I was doing a lot of workshops, public workshops, and I would do them on the weekend because my husband could actually obviously be home to look after, like, Levi, my eldest. But it's not to say it was easy at all. There was definitely times. Also, I was working, like, basically in a room off the kitchen. So whenever the kid, you know, whenever he was home, it was him coming in and out, in and out. But he was 3. So it wasn't like he's demanding, but not as demanding as a brand new baby or a toddler. So I want to put that out there. But I also really time managed and time blocked to be like, I can do this amount of work at this time, this amount of work, you know, on Tuesdays, I start from here to here. And there definitely was working at night sometimes as well.
What I've heard a lot from people who listen to my podcast, who are either podcasters or their business relies on creating content, which obviously most businesses these days rely on creating content. People are always like to me, you put out so much, how do you do it? And I'm like, well, my background has been in writing and video production for the last 10 years. So it's easier for me, but I still find it really challenging and really time consuming. You seem to have been very content driven in your approach to building your business. How did you go about making that as streamlined as possible?
Yeah, it's still not as streamlined as possible. And I'll have months where it's really working well and other months where it's not. So literally I said to you before I got on this call that it was 10 minutes before our call. And I thought, I went through my podcast tracker and was like, what can I record in 10 minutes? And just did a episode 367, you know, in 7 minutes, and then gave myself, you know, 3 minutes before this one. So I do jump into pockets of time all the time.
That makes me feel better because you look like you have it all nailed out. And sometimes I'm like, sometimes I'll package up every social media post for an episode, for example. Other times I'm making them on the fly. So you've already made me feel better.
Oh no, I try to. And also, like, even yesterday I was going through the edits of my book, my new book, and there's, you know, the publisher, they've got an editor, she's gone through it. And I was finding myself getting defensive of her edits. And I was like, that's a podcast episode, you know, let the experts do their thing and don't bring your ego into it. And so I literally paused and did it. So if something comes to me, I will just jump on it because I think that's the thing. And I think also that's what I've taught from motherhood, that if you need to do something like get back to somebody's birthday party invite, just do it now because the kids distract you and not distract you, but, you know, it's life. Life, not even the kids distract you. That's a horrible thing to say, but life gets in the way sometimes. And then, so I think if you have a great idea, just jump on it. The other thing is, like you, I'd come from a content background. So I had been used to writing. I mean, when I had that column in The Age, I had to go to 4 events in a week and then write 600 words at the end of one of those events on Thursday so that it would be ready to edit and everything and get out into the paper on Sunday. And sometimes if there was a big event on a Friday night, it had to be in by midnight that night. So I've been used to working on deadlines for, you know, 2 decades. And so I feel like that also comes into play, whereas people who haven't had that background, you know, they might dissect things, think about things. I also repurpose a lot of content. So last year, my back went out and I couldn't do anything for about 8 weeks. And every single email that went out in that 8 weeks was something that was repurposed from the year prior. So even my most diehard fans who I know read every email, they'll be like, oh, this was a great one this week. And I think, you had that same email sent to you, you know, 11 months ago.
Hot tip. Love it.
Yeah. So I feel like repurposing content is a huge thing that people don't do. They feel like they have to start from scratch all the time. In terms of the actual process, though, I do have like say, for instance, with the podcast, we are just mapping out every episode for all of 2024. And the way that we do that is to come up with 4 or 5 content pillars and then be like, okay, there's 52 episodes. We need 10 per content pillar. And then I put them into an Excel sheet. And then when it comes time to do the podcast, I just go to the Excel sheet, read it, and riff. I think the riffing is also important. Lots of people write their podcast from start to finish. And I think that when I started doing that, I used to actually just read out old emails that I'd sent. And now I just talk because I'm so used to it. And I think the more you do it, the better it is. Plus I coach full day, so I'm talking all day long. And then in terms of social media or other things, I always think start with whatever the message is first, then the medium, and then the distribution channels, which for one is social media. In terms of the graphics, I have an assistant who creates all our graphics and puts them into later. And then it's up to me to go in and write the captions and schedule stuff. But on Mondays is when I do my content. If I don't get it done on Monday, it pretty much doesn't get done. That was a really long-winded answer. Sorry.
That's great to know. No, it's good though. There's so many little tips in there. So I love it. So then you've started your business. I think you've been in business for about a year at this stage. And then sadly, you experienced a pregnancy loss in 2016, I believe. How did you navigate that? And did owning your own business help you to get through that? Or do you feel like there was a period there where you were a bit deflated in business because you were going through so much personally?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I have often thought, thank God I had my own business when I went through that, because the pace of which I was running as head of marketing at MIMCO would not have allowed for me to have the grieving time that I needed. That baby was so wanted and so planned. And in my head, because I'm a planner, as soon as we got pregnant, I was like, okay, so then the baby will come in November, which will give me enough time to do this, then I'll take this time off. And like, I had planned it all out until that baby was like 2 years old. And so to lose it was just horrendous. And really, I think I went into like grief for 6 months after that, because it was just this, such a shock. Like, oh no, but I just had a baby really quickly the first time. It all went perfectly. You know, this is just going to happen. I'm just going to be one of those lucky people. And I'm really glad that actually the miscarriage happened the second child that I had, not the first time. My heart goes out to people who have that as their first experience, because I think it would be incredibly hard to pick yourself back up and keep going. I also felt it really difficult because I was getting to be friends with people who were running businesses who were also having babies. And I felt like everyone around me just got pregnant really easily. And so I probably threw myself into work, to be honest, because I knew that that was something I could do, whereas my body had failed me, according to me.
And how did you actually emotionally navigate that time? I mean, you mentioned a period of about 6 months of grieving. Did you sit with it much? I feel like sometimes in motherhood, we have to ignore the big feelings. And I can't speak for miscarriage because that hasn't happened to me at this stage. But in motherhood in general, I feel like we often push down the really hard feelings because they are really hard. Was there a sense of that?
Yeah, it was. It was hard because the other person who's going through it, obviously, is my husband, but we're both going through our own pain. And I had felt incredibly guilty that my body had not done what it was supposed to do. And then also we'd had stupid but well-meaning family say things like, oh, you just work too hard. If you hadn't worked so hard. And so then I had all this stuff about maybe it was all the stress and the cortisol and all the things from my old job and just, you know, this constant telling yourself off kind of thing. But the thing that really helped me then was my mum. So my mum had 2 miscarriages herself, and she came over numerous times. We watched movies. She brought all this junk food. Like, I just remember sitting and crying with her, and just as much as I wanted to, I could just keep saying to her, you know, like, what else about, you know, how did you get through this and how did you get through that? Also, she'd been a midwife and a postnatal psychiatric nurse. So she was incredible. But I think it was really hard. My other 3 siblings had all had 2 children at least. And I remember like going to their house and just getting really kind of upset and resentful that like they just all had it so easy and none of them had a miscarriage. And yeah, I think that took its toll. I did a lot of research and reading and that time. Yeah.
Sounds like you have an incredibly supportive mother there. So then I guess the conception challenges continue until you eventually look into IVF. Can you tell us about what happened next?
Yeah. So I rallied against IVF. I was really against it. If anyone brought it up, my sister's a GP and she brought it up. My normal GP brought it up and I'd be like, I don't need that. Like, I'm not one of those people. Like, it was
real. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's because you felt like your body should be able to just do it or something?
Yeah. Yeah,
okay.
And I felt like, which now there's so much more talk about IVF, but I feel like even at the time it was like, oh, we're not going to tell people we're doing this. And it was like secret. And I just had felt like that was for, like, I just couldn't get my head around the fact that I'd had a natural pregnancy twice. One hadn't worked, but, you know, I'd had my first. So I was like, what, why can't I do this? And I think at work, if you're ambitious and you get promoted quickly, you can easily like sort of find like, okay, what's the solution here? What am I doing? You know, Excel sheet it. And this was a real problem that I couldn't solve. And I did everything. So before I went to IVF, I had a health coach. I had like 50 different naturopaths. I changed my diet. I went keto. I mean, I did everything and it was not working. And I was getting more and more frustrated. And then we saw an IVF specialist who told us, she's like, nothing's wrong with you. You'll be pregnant in 3 months naturally. I'm just going to give you this, you know, whatever medicine it was. Then I thought, oh, that's good. That's it. That's the golden ticket. And it didn't happen. And then my mum passed away. And so just before we started IVF, so I just said, that's it. I'm sick of trying all of this. I'm going to just leave it for a while. And then we did try IVF. We tried IUI first. It didn't work. And then IVF worked first round.
I'm so sorry to hear about that. You don't have to go there if you don't want to. I wasn't aware of this, but I always think that motherhood has like ripped off some of my protective layers. And I do worry even more so probably now about losing my own mum. How do you navigate that when you're a mum yourself?
Yeah, it was really horrible because nothing was wrong with her. My dad was the one with all the health issues. And he called me one night. He's like, mum's gone into hospital, but it's fine. Can you give me a lift? Because I don't want to get a taxi. And he didn't want to drive at night. I was like, yeah, sure. And then my parents had gone into hospital for other things. So I was like, this will be fine. And then he called back later. He said, you know what? I'm getting a taxi. The hospital's just called and I need to get there as soon as possible. My dad never got taxis ever. So I was like, okay, this is serious. I got there. And within half an hour, she died. So she got into the ambulance thinking, I don't feel well, but I'm just going to go. She actually brought a book with her. She said to my dad, Frank, stay home, have your dinner, don't stress. I'll read the book. I'll be in the hospital. I'll probably be sitting in emergency for ages. And then she passed away pretty much in the ambulance of a blood clot that had gone to her heart. So by the time I got to the hospital, I was like, oh no, she'll be fine. And then I walk in and then all the nurses are looking at you because you're like, what? It's like a slow-mo horrible film. So that was like gut-wrenching. There's nothing else to say about it. It was just the worst because she was my best friend. She was everything to me. And we talked every day. And yeah, it was just like a big, your world can explode overnight.
Try not to get too emotional.
I know.
So sorry that you went through that. You're holding yourself better together than I am, but I'm so sorry that you went through that. I'm glad you had such a beautiful, supportive mother.
Yeah.
You do eventually fall pregnant, and that probably feels like some beautiful gift after what you'd been through. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So the day that they implanted the egg, I'm quite into like signs and everything, but the day they implanted it, my parents have always used this one particular password and like a numbers. And I then started using it and it's got part of my mum's birthday in it. And I always use it. And, you know, I shouldn't probably say that out loud. But anyway, when I went to put the date on the day they implanted the egg, it was that exact password. And that was the one that worked. And so I often think mum was involved somehow in this. So it was incredible because I was actually doing a conference for Etsy the day that I got the egg implanted and they had put me up in this hotel and it was all very nice. And I said to the nurse when she implanted the egg, I have to go to a conference now and talk for like 4 hours. Is it going to like fall out? And she said, actually, that's amazing because you'll have adrenaline, your body will be pumping blood all around. You're going to be standing and walking. And, you know, she's like, this is great. A lot of people go and lie down all day and that's fine. But she's like, this is actually going to energize and put a lot of blood and oxygen into your body. So she's like, this is a great thing. And I was a bit worried at that conference thinking, oh my God, am I screwing up my chances again with work? But then I just lay down in the hotel as soon as I got home and had this really lovely evening and yeah. And then we were pregnant and it was just like a miracle. It is still a miracle. Yeah.
So you had lost a pregnancy, you had lost your mother and then you're full pregnant. How did you feel during that pregnancy when you'd, I guess, been through a lot?
Yeah, I felt I really missed my mum. Also, we'd had lots of family drama from the fallout of my mother's death. Also, my father, we had to put him into a nursing home. So I had to sell his house, put him into a nursing home. He was getting early dementia. So it wasn't like this, it wasn't definitely not like London where it had just been this lovely cup of roses. But it was wonderful. However, I couldn't shake that something's going to go wrong because it had, which is where I think that if you have that the first time, I don't know how you then enjoy any of your pregnancies. At least I'd had that first one to enjoy. So nothing went wrong. Everything was good. My son also started primary school that year. So there was just lots of change happening. So there was just, it was busyness. And then, yeah, he came through halfway through 2019.
And we talk a lot about, which is not the phase of life that I'm in yet, but I'm so aware of it and so sympathetic of it, the idea that people in their, I guess, midlife, I'm assuming your age, but that age of where your parents are aging and you're caregiving for them, but your kids are still really young or they're babies and you're caring for them. What was the weight of, I mean, I assume it continues, but what was the weight of that specific time like when you're doing all of these different caregiving on top of working?
It was really hard. And I feel like one of the things that has come out that I've been more aware of is that, say, when my son started primary school, a lot of my good friends, their kids start primary school and they become really good friends with all the mums that start primary school. But because my dad was alone in the nursing home and I was pregnant, one, I was really tired. I was also like, I got to drop you to school and then I got to run to get work done because I'm trying to bank up money before we have this baby. But also, as soon as I picked my son up from school, we'd just drive to the nursing home and we'd sit with my dad for the whole evening and then come home, get dinner ready and everything else. And if I had any spare time to myself where my husband would have the kids, I would go and sit with dad. Like, because my sister lives 2 hours away, she would come up once a week. My brothers did see him, but not as often. So I lived in the next suburb to his nursing home. So I was there all the time and he would call like, oh, can you go to Coles and can you pick up XYZ, because he had his own little sort of apartment. So I feel like that was just this, I mean, you just keep going. You're just like, okay, this needs to get done, this needs to get done. I just made my work fit around it. Plus that's when I really got into courses and putting courses online so that that would be an income where I didn't have to physically be there. And so that worked well. I'd also put an ebook out in 2018 and that had sold really, really well. So I felt like I was investigating ways to make money that didn't involve me physically being there because I wanted to be there for my dad.
That's really smart. And so I will go to your second son now. How did early motherhood like as a business owner and a mother of two this time?
Yeah, that was full on and was definitely not my green juice, go to the park, do whatever I want all day. It was hot, like it was not great. So my dad was going downhill. He actually passed away when my son was 6 months old, my second child. So I had that. I also, my second child needed surgery at 5 months old because he wasn't feeding. He was really small when he was born and then he didn't feed and I just couldn't get him to breastfeed and latch. With my first son, I had some issues, but then we'd figured it out and he breastfed for a year, or 11 months or something. This second child, I was just constantly pumping. I had a double pump on at all times of the day. It was just this stress. I really didn't want to put him on a formula. Again, this societal sort of pressure. So my sister, 8 or 9 weeks in, said, your mental health is going to be impacted if you don't start formula. So put him onto formula. That really helped. But in terms of work, prior to him being born, I had set up my courses, especially Marketing for Your Small Business, which is our biggest course and most expensive. So I had set that up so people could buy that. So that had done well and got a chunk. Plus I'd also organized group coaching. So I decided that I would take 3 months off completely. Then I would have 3 months where I just did group coaching, which was every fortnight, 1 hour. And then at 6 months, I would go back into normal work. We also got a nanny because I've been offered a book deal. So I had to write the book in the first 3 months of his life. So I was like, how are we going to do this? So I talked to my husband, and because we didn't have anyone that could come and help, like my mum was passed away, my dad wasn't in a space to do this. So we paid for a nanny for 4 hours a week. She was incredible. She was in her 60s and she just said, I'll be your stand-in mum while she, and she was just lovely. She'd lost her parents in her 30s as well. So she just understood and she was incredible. However, then, COVID hit. So no one could be there. And then that, I think, was the hardest because dad had just passed away. COVID hit. We had my mother-in-law coming once a week. We had the nanny coming for 4 hours and both of them couldn't come because, they need to protect themselves. And so I had the business starting up again, the book and everything, like all of the publicity and everything for that, plus COVID, plus homeschooling my child who was in grade one, and then a baby, and then my husband had to work full time at home to keep everything going as well. So it was horrible, horrible.
Was that just, did you even like, is there even any tip around how you got through that? Or is that just keep going and do what you can and keep going?
Yeah, just keep going. I think also because I was listening to so many small business owners and I was there, you know, there to support them, I kind of had to put my stuff to the back burner. But it was a really good time where, you know, we also did do lots of things as a family, like go for walks and everything else. But in terms of how I did it, I think I just was like really tag teaming, again, really supportive partner. And I, you know, heart goes out to anyone who's a single parent trying to do this alone, because that support was incredible. He would say, okay, I've got a meeting from this time to this time, but then I could be with Elio, who's the youngest one, and you go and do X, Y, Z. But I definitely, like, I remember having a group coaching session and I just broke down and I felt awful. I'm the coach. I'm supposed to help everyone else. And this wonderful woman, Kate Stokes from Coco Flip, who was doing the group coaching, I just remember she just stood in. She was like, okay, Fiona's going through a bit. I am going to stand in and we're going to talk about it. And I was like, thank you, Kate. Because I was just not, it was just like, it's all too much. And I think that was a really a good turning point to be like, I don't have to always be this perfect, strong person. I can be like, it's really shit. I'm having a really hard time.
Man, that is a lot.
Yeah.
I'm going to assume that you've worked with a lot of female-led businesses. What do you think are the biggest challenges that mothers and women in general face when it comes to business?
Not trusting themselves at all. I think women feel like they have to be an expert. I mean, it's been statistically proven that women won't apply for a job unless they've got 10 out of 10, whereas a man will apply for a job who's got 6 out of 10 of the things that are being required. I work with about 40% men in one-on-one coaching, but I would say pretty much all group coaching is women. I feel this is a generalization, but I do feel that men are less likely to show what's wrong in a group setting, whereas they will when it's just a one-on-one coach. But I think from that, I just think women have this tendency to apologize for success at the same time, like not rush towards it, but be like, oh, okay. Oh, I guess, God, I must have got lucky there. It's like, no, you did the work to get there. I just think they put other people's priorities above their own at all times. I also think women, you know, we really do judge each other. And I think we need to stop, because I think a lot of men don't judge, you know, necessarily judge us in the way that we think. It's other women. So I'll think, oh God, the women at school think I don't do enough, or that I'm working all the time, or, you know, these aunties or whatever are thinking that I, you know, the house isn't perfectly clean because, you know, I'm working too much, or I'm taking care of the kids too much, and then I'm not doing enough in my business. And look at these other women in business who are doing better. So I feel like we can be our own worst critics, but also we don't trust ourselves enough to just go, you know what, I'm going to start a podcast. Let's see how it goes. You know, I took 3 years before I started the podcast after having the idea, because I was like, oh no, I've got a really nasally voice, or just stuff. Whereas men, I feel like, will just be like, yeah, I'm going to go for that. I'm probably going to smash it.
We tend to get in our own way a lot, don't we? Like, I even personally pretty much share nothing about this podcast on my personal platforms because I'm just too, I don't know, embarrassed. I don't know what the word is, but you've just made me make that correlation between, I think, what a lot of women go through.
Yeah.
And yeah, I just won't put myself out there in the way that I probably should, and it's probably hurt my business. So that's really interesting. I know that you're really big on workflow and terms like batching. What do you think are some of, I mean, I don't, the word productive annoys me sometimes because we don't always have to be productive, but when you're a mum, you only have a certain amount of hours to work in a day, so you want them to count. What are some workflows or tips that you have around a mother who's time poor getting the most out of her paid work days?
So I would be looking at always prioritizing. Like, what are the, I always have like a memo board with three things. And so every night before I finish up for the day, I'll write the three things that need to get done the next day. If nothing else gets done, these three things need to get done. So I feel like that helps me feel productive, even if I'm not actually being productive. The other thing is analytics. Like, I've been in marketing and, you know, especially at places like Amazon or Audible or even a Country Road Group, analytics are absolutely key to every choice that you make, and so a rigid decision. So I feel like in my own business, I have analytics around the podcast downloads because I know that that has a dramatic effect on sales for our business. The Sunday email has a dramatic effect on things if that open rate goes down. But my Instagram doesn't really have a real, I mean, it's kind of keeping me, you know, relevant. I understand the buyer cycle and everything else. And it's great to actually be social in the DMs. However, if something has to give, it's always social media in my business. Because I'm like, you know what? I'm not going to get bogged down by that. So there's been periods, and I know people be like, oh, you work in marketing. But there's been periods where I haven't posted on social media for a whole month or 6 weeks because I'm like, this is not a priority right now. And the kids are, or this thing's happening. And as long as that podcast keeps going out, the Sunday email keeps going out, I know that they have an impact on my business. So I think that understanding, if you're in an employed role, you know, when I was at Mimco, we had about 19 people underneath, I hate saying that, in the marketing team. We had about 19 people in three separate teams, and I was the manager. And so, you know, I had to look at, like, is getting bogged down in this politics worth it? Or is having another meeting about that thing worth it? As opposed to how can we do things effectively? So, for example, instead of, I mean, I did have one-on-ones with people, but instead of catching up with every single person in that 19 people, which would have taken half the week, when we had a team meeting, I would make time at the start for everyone to go around and do wins and challenges, and also a point of inspiration, like what's inspired you this week? And so then they got a chance to talk about what was annoying them, what had gone well, but in a finite 5-minute kind of period, as opposed to people kind of, you know, standing there and talking to you for 45 minutes. I know that makes me sound really antisocial, but just really being clear on, like, this needs to get done today. So what is all the peripheral clutter that I can get rid of?
That's great advice. I have one more question for you. I did a business session with you, which I'll probably mention in the intro so that people don't just feel like they don't understand why I'm asking you the questions I do. But I just find your advice so valuable. So I highly recommend that people look up your work if they haven't already. What's the biggest piece of advice you'd give to the Fiona that was just about to become a mother, and how you would tell her to, I guess, what advice you'd give her around making work work as a mum?
I would say trust yourself, whether you're working or not, trust yourself as a mother. There's so much information coming at you from other people, and lots of them mean well, but you have a mother's instinct for that reason. Trust yourself. I did not trust myself with my first child. I read every single book that was out there, and I think that kind of added to stress instead of taking away from it. But I think in terms of work, like, I guess I always think, will it matter in 5 years? Like, if I don't send this email today, is it going to matter in 5 years? Probably not. If I don't get to my son's assembly where he's getting an award and he really asked me to be there, that matters. That'll matter. That might be something that matters. And so I always think, will this matter? And I think also, without getting all sad, and I feel like I, you know, people have said, oh, you mentioned the death of your parents a lot. I'm like, yeah, because it's been a huge influence. But I think that the death of both my parents has also put into perspective, life is so short. My best friend died when I was 21 in a car crash. You know, you're not guaranteed anything tomorrow. So when I was working at Mimco, I remember thinking, I'm giving so much of my time and effort to this as opposed to my son. And I've only got a couple more years until he's at school. So I think that is the biggest advice I'd say. Yes, you need to make, most people need to make money. I'm not shying away from that, but put it in perspective, you know, put it in perspective. Your family is the most important thing. Work comes and goes, but you can't get time back.
I feel like you've lived 5 different career and personal lives, so you have so much to teach people. So that's a beautiful sentiment to end with. Fiona, if people want to find your business online, where should they go?
You can just go to mydailybusiness.com, or you can find us on Instagram at mydailybusiness_.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you. And thank you also for giving people a platform. I feel like so many mums feel intense guilt around working and being a mum. And I think you have to remember you were a person before you became a mother, and you can have both of them can work. There's not an either or, you have to choose. I think they can both work. You just need to figure it out. So I think a podcast like yours is so important. So thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Ready or Not. If you liked the show, please tell your friends, subscribe, or write a review. You can also find us on Instagram at readyornot.pod. That's it for today. We'll see you next time.